Hello, and welcome back to Dedication. Fans, remember the Bay City Rollers. This week, we're back with Wayne Coy, the author of the book Bay City Babylon, the unbelievable but true story of the Bay City Rollers. Last week, we ended our session by asking Wayne when and how he decided to write the book. This week's session, we'll find that out. And we also will delve into the inception of the original Idols tour that featured the Bay City Rollers, Barry Williams, or as we know him, Greg Brady, Leif Garrett, the Cal Sills, and more. Let's check back in with Wayne. So the book came out in 2005 initially. Now, did the Where Are They Now interviews and research, like was that the genesis of the book, or how did that happen, and tell us about the process.
Right, so my wife at the time was at home. It was a regular day during the week. I was living in Tucson, Arizona, and I had always been a program director / morning DJ, right? And this job was the first one that I had in years where I wasn't the program director. I was only the lowly morning man, right? So what that equaled was way less hours at the radio station and way more hours around the house. And the real fact of the matter is, it was driving my wife crazy.
Yeah. What is that slot? The 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. slot?
Yeah,
you were home at 11. That was not good.
Right. She was used to me being at the station all day, being the guy wearing two hats. You know, I would literally work from like 5 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day.
Oh, boy.
Now all of a sudden I'm coming home at, 11 a.m. And yeah, so she came to me and she said, listen, you either need to take up golf or collecting stamps or something, but you need to find a hobby and you need to find it quick because you're driving me crazy.
I have
a routine. You know, she was a housewife. I hate to use that term because I know it's kind of demeaning, but she was a domestic goddess.
Yeah.
And she just said, look, you're in my space and you're driving me crazy, so find something. So I'm like, yeah, okay, don't ask me twice, you know? So I went upstairs and I got out some boxes and I'm just literally digging through going, okay, is it going to be baseball cards or, what have I got in the box that might inspire me to do something? And I literally pulled out this envelope, and in the envelope, manila envelope, pretty dog-eared, were the cassettes from my interviews with Alan and Woody and Duncan, and a bunch of, written notes. You know, you listen to cassette and you transcribe it, and,
sure.
You know, you want to make sure you get your quotes right, so all of that. So it was just all sitting there, and, keep in mind, this is 2003. And, so this stuff's already almost 20 years old. And I immediately went, wait a minute, you know what? Nobody has ever written, like, a book. I mean, and I'm not talking about the Tam Payton book or the Michael, whatever his name was. But I mean, this wasn't, I don't mean like a glossy fan book, where you talk about their favorite, flavor of ice cream.
Right.
Nobody ever did a real biography on the band. And I thought back to, knowing how much Eric opened up to me playing slots in Lake Tahoe, that these guys, I mentioned, you went to them and said, look, I'm writing a serious book about, you as a rock band, because you deserve it. You've sold a bajillion records and you have a huge fan base. Why don't we do this thing? So anyway, off to the races. I'm not knowing at all how hard it is to write a biography, especially about a band that's not together anymore, that's splintered all over the place, a lot of bad, juju between the members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And half of them are in the UK, the others are who knows where. So it was a lot more of a challenge than I thought it was going to be. That said, I had a lot of hours to kill, So from Tucson, we moved back to Alabama. Even though my inner voice was telling me how, I did it anyway. Went back to Alabama and locked myself away and just kept writing and calling and interviewing. And I approached everybody who I thought could have any sort of meaningful take on the group. And, you know, if you look at it from a percentage point, as far as actual participation, people who said, sure, let's talk. As you're probably, you know, learning yourself during your podcast.
Yeah.
So you get about, if you get about 300, you're doing good. You know, if you get 3 out of 10 to say yes. Of the members themselves, you know, Nobby was happy to talk. Ian certainly had no problem talking. Duncan was fine. Les loved the idea and was initially way into having a conversation, and then he told me, he goes, you know what, he goes, I'm writing a book too, and if I talk to you, I'm going to end up telling you all the stories that are going to end up being in my book, so that doesn't make any sense. So for that reason, I got to say, I'm just going to take a pass.
Okay.
Eric, which I appreciated, at least he was candid. The rest were, you know, Derek was thanks but no thanks. Alan and I did have a conversation, which was good. So he participated. It wasn't as long as the previous one, but, you know, a lot of the stuff he told me also ended up being not really, you know, earth-shattering news because it was all covered the first time I talked to him.
Sure.
And thankfully, I have gobs from Woody. I have just a ton that never saw the light of day from the from that interview in 84. And it was all history stuff, you know, it was his relationship with the other members and Tam and, you know, what he thought the Rollers meant and the big picture and, you know, so I was glad to have that. And then the rest, as any biographer has to deal with at some point, you know, you just have to go source material. And I did say to all of them, like, look, and even, you know, even to Les and Eric, I said, you know, I would so much rather have an opportunity for you to tell me your story from your perspective with your spin, because it's going to be different than the other guys, but at least you have a chance to control the narrative, you know, to whatever degree. You know, I'm gonna take what you say and put it in the mix.
Yeah.
And I was a little surprised that they all didn't see the value in that, but, you know, that's why they call it an unauthorized biography, and we all do what we can to get the real story. And that was my whole thing from Jump Street, was I'm like, hey, I am really not going to go into this with any sort of perspective. I'm not on one member's side or another's. You know, we let the chips fall where they are, and they'll either participate or they won't. And then I'm going to have to, you know, rely on anything they may have ever said in the past, if it relates to that moment. And, you know, looking back on it, I mean, it's the first effort to write a book, quite an undertaking. I'm proud of it. I would love to, you know, there's a lot of woulda, shoulda, couldas, and, you know, we can all say that, right? You have to live with it, warts and all, and you go, hey, at the end of it, are you proud of it? And the answer is, the response that I've gotten from most people, especially people who aren't in that inner clique, because I didn't want to write it for the people that live and die with the Rollers, because they probably know better than I was ever going to find out anyway.
Right.
You know, it's not, and so that would be the common critique from someone who was a hardcore Roller fan as well. It's nothing new, is it? I would say, yeah, it is, because, you know, who else talked to Sid Bernstein? Who else spent this much time with Tam Payton? Who else talked to Clive Davis? Who else talked to Mike Kleffner? You know, I mean, everybody that I thought could speak to their time in the band or around the band either participated or I was able to include their perspective. And, you know, up until I think there's a book that came out a couple years ago that, boy, you know.
Oh, yeah. The Spence book.
Yeah.
That's a big book. I don't know that I've even gotten through it, because
it's a tough read. It's very tough.
It's a hard read. The first half of the book, I thought, you know, of course I wish I hadn't read it, but I found the first half to be super tedious. he just went into so much minutia that I thought was, I don't know, just didn't add anything. But I just wish I'd never read it.
See, and you're a fan, you know, and a big fan. So imagine someone who, as I say at the beginning of my book, is aided recall, you know?
Right.
You guys know this. You talk about the Rollers, and you literally have to sing Saturday night sometimes for them to go, oh, yeah.
Right.
You know, from San Francisco? No. You know, they don't know.
Yeah.
And so it's out of sight, out of mind. So when I wrote the book, the idea was write a book that is going to hopefully hold the attention of the super fan, because there'll be enough new material there that, you know, that maybe they never got to hear what Sid Bernstein thought or what Clive Davis thought or
right.
whatever. But for the uninitiated, for the person who just hasn't thought about them since 76, what's that feedback like? And I will tell you that at the end of the day, that's the most valuable feedback, because they didn't go into reading the book with any sort of preconceived notions. And usually what I get back at the end of it is, whoa, I never had any idea that they went through all this stuff.
Exactly.
And to the band members' credit, that, you know, they all deserve utmost respect for having gone through what they've gone through, because it was a whirlwind, and as you know, there were so many extenuating circumstances, and you know, there were facts of life that they just sort of had to deal with once they became card-carrying members of that band, and it's sad. I don't know how else to put it. It's just bittersweet and sad, because they deserved better. They really did.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And you kind of answered my next question about the ride or die fans who, you know, anything that you said that didn't involve milk and teddy bears and cuddling, they were just going to freak out and, you know, leave a bad review. So you kind of covered that. And Laura, I'm not going to correct you, but I think when you meant you wish you never read the book, not because it isn't a well-written book, but it's because it's so, so, so dark.
Yes,
so dark.
It's very dark. And, you know, I was one of those fans that totally believed their milk drinking image. And
oh, I'm sorry, Laura.
But it makes me really sad to think that at the height of their popularity, when I loved and worshipped everything about them, that behind the scenes they had, you know, that awful Tam Payton behind them driving the bus, and
yeah,
as an adult it makes me sad.
Oh, I want to hug you right now.
I know, it's stupid, I'm sorry.
No, it's not stupid. It's you know, it's who we are and what we do.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay.
All right, Wayne, bring some Mandis up in here.
Well, I just wanted to say on the record that when speaking about a dark book, that Laura was in no way speaking of my book, Simon. Just
no, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I got a hard time because, you know, and again, it's what it should have, could have, but I was like, okay, there was a chapter in the book which I think we might have taken out completely on the second, because we did an updated version in 2015, 10 years later.
Mm-hmm.
I did a chapter where I interviewed these girls that all had one thing in common, and that's that they were all down in L.A. You know, they were like super fans who got to get close to them all while they were down there, and, you know, hang out with them at La Park and
yeah.
go to the Murph and tapings and
right.
all that stuff. And, you know, the stories they told, which, by the way, aren't my stories, they're their stories, were not received really well by a lot of the fans, because they thought it was just, okay, why'd you need to go there? You know, we didn't need that. It was like a little too
yeah.
tabloid. And,
But I
see what they're saying. Anyway, at the time, you know, I thought it was different. I thought, hey, let's hear what these girls all went through, because it's different than some girl who was just a fan and, you know, bought 16 magazine every month and had them on the wall and then kind of forgot about them, you know, by 19. Yeah. 19- in the 80 and moved on to, you know, Rick Springfield or whatever.
Now,
right?
Now, the anniversary edition did not include that chapter, am I right? Because I think I missed it. I read the second edition.
Good. Okay, because you're doing a better job of remembering than me, because remember now, that's already been 5 years ago.
Yeah.
So, yes, it was a conscious decision to listen to the criticism that I felt was pretty well-founded in that it was such a departure from the rest of the narrative in the book that it stuck out like a sore thumb. Uh-huh. Not saying that it was bad to have, but I just didn't see the point.
Was the criticism from the, you know, the milk drinking fans, or was it from the girls themselves? Did they not feel represented?
I don't know because I never drank milk with any of them. So you know, I think it was. Yeah, I would say to be my perspective on that is it was probably the ones who were like, listen, don't. You know, it's one thing that we have to hear about the drug usage and that we have to hear about, you know, Tam's ulterior motive, and we have to hear about, you know, this or that, whatever it might have been. But seriously, do we have to hear about, you know, some girl who, you know, was basically a groupie who ended up sleeping with a member of the band or whatever?
Yeah.
Now you're in Caroline Sullivan territory, and, you know, that was her whole book. And
yeah.
I appreciated her book. I thought it was great because yeah. That was her story. I mean,
exactly.
I loved her book. I thought it was a great book.
Yeah. I did too.
Yeah.
And I like it because it stands for what it is, and it takes it. So my book, since I had a do-over, I chose not to include that, you know? So there's some new chapters to obviously get you up to date or as much
right.
as we could
yep.
in 10 years. And then there was an interview that Hannes Johnson had done with Tam Payton that I thought was a pretty extensive interview. And so I approached him and said, hey, are you cool if I include your entire interview in this new version of the book? And he was, you know, he was honored that I asked and appreciative that I thought it was such a good interview, because it was, because you love him or hate him, the Rollers were not on the phone today
yeah.
talking.
Yeah.
If it is Tam Payton, period.
Yeah,
it
he was.
Right.
Whatever
so
he was, he was a genius.
The other stuff doesn't matter. It's like having a conversation about the Beatles and not you know, understanding that it doesn't happen without Brian.
Exactly.
You know? And funnily enough, for the same reasons, they both had the same sort of attractions or whatever. And I don't want to get into Tam and his, you know, his thing, but I will say that interview that he did with Hannes was, you know, it was beyond the surface. It gave him a chance to really express himself in good or bad ways, but I just felt like, okay, this is better narrative than three or four girls who hung around with him in L.A. in the late 70s, and, you know.
Yeah. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, that story is probably not that unique. There were other cities, other girls, other hotels, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. They were young men.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Is it possible to buy your book?
Is it possible, I'm sorry?
To buy your book? If somebody, after hearing this podcast, wants to read your book, where can they buy it?
Do you know what? It was about 2 years ago that the publisher approached me and said, listen, you can keep this thing in print, but we're going to actually need you to pay because
oh,
I guess
no.
Well, it's not a lot of money, but it's money to keep it in print. And I thought, you know what, probably anybody that's going to want to read it has probably already read it. So rather than spend a couple grand to keep it in print with that particular publisher, now I've learned since that I could have taken it, because it's my manuscript, I own it lock, stock, and barrel, so I could have, so I suppose I could still put it out again, but it's available through Amazon as a Kindle book, so you can download it and read it on your Kindle, and you can still see all the pictures and the cover art and all of that. But as far as actual paperback copies go, I think as of 2017 or 18. It's officially out of print, which is nuts because I saw a copy of it on eBay for like $80.
Oh, wow.
I know, and I had to pay $80 to buy a copy of my own book.
Wow.
So there you go.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, that says something. That's awesome.
I'm kidding.
Wayne, tell us about the original Idol show that you were involved with that reunited Duncan and Ian for a time.
Thanks, that was fun. So I got out of radio day to day and moved to Las Vegas to work with radio as opposed to on radio for a timeshare company called Consolidated Resorts. Their big property is called Tahiti Village, still there, but they were huge timeshare company. I was exposed to them because in radio they would approach us and say, hey, how would you like to do your morning show live from Las Vegas? And of course you want to do that. And they would fly you out, put you up, and you could do your show. Of course, at a cost, which meant you had to give out their 800 number on the air, right?
Sure.
Well, I experienced that as a program director and morning guy, and thought it was great. So did our listeners, and they asked me if I wanted to come to Vegas and work for them, and I decided I did. So I moved there to be their national promotions director, and while I was there doing that as my day job, I started to meet a lot of the people that were involved on the entertainment side of things. And now keep in mind, I had already managed Duncan at that point for a long time. So my whistle had been wet, let's just say. I really am attracted to the whole performance side of things and management. And so I was like, okay, well, what's not being done? What could be a cool like concept for the casinos? And I came up with the idea of the original Idols as a touring production, and the only litmus test, or the litmus test, I guess, was every one of the acts had to have spent sometime on the bedroom walls of a teenage girl, you know?
Or boy!
And within a certain, realistic, okay, it doesn't make any sense to put, Bobby Sherman out with, Sean Cassidy, right? They don't share a fan base.
Okay.
But in about a 10-year span, I figured that way you get older sister, maybe younger sister, if they're 5 years apart, you can maybe get them both, plus their husbands, to buy t-shirts, of course, at the end of the show. And so I went about the idea of casting this thing, and Rollers was, of course, first thought I had. And I went to Duncan and I said, hey, what do you think? You want to do this? And he said, well, who would I do it with? And, his first choice was Eric. And I don't think Eric wanted anything to do with the Rollers at that point. So then we went from there. And it's easy because then you go, okay, well, check them all off the list. Les had his touring version of the band, but the idea of bringing them over to be available at a moment's notice, that's not going to work. So we'd probably have to be U.S.-based. So one and one is two. Hello, Ian Mitchell, right?
Yeah.
So we asked Ian and Wendy, and they were all in. So we thought, okay, well, at least we've got them on board. Now, how do we bill it? Because you need the name, or at least some version of the name. And Ian was at that time doing shows as Ian Mitchell's Bay City Rollers, I think.
Yep, we saw that too.
I could be wrong, but I think that's how he was billing it. And Duncan wasn't doing anything except being Duncan. I mean, he had just moved back from South Africa, so he hadn't really done anything rollerish in a while. So we got them on board. Then I went and basically reunited the Cowsills after 10 years.
Oh, wow.
They hadn't played a note together. And, timing is everything. I reached out to Bob Cowsill, found out he was playing at a pub in L.A., and I called the pub and left a message. They put a sticky note on, I learned all this later, they put a sticky note on his piano, on his guitar stand, and that guitar stand note stayed there for like 2 months, and he kept looking at it going, Wayne Coy, I don't know who this guy is, and finally, he returned my call after like 2 months. And I just shot it to him straight. I'm like, look, I'm putting together hopefully a lineup of teen idols. We'll have a common backing band, but, you know, you can play as much as makes sense up in front, and you'll play your hits and then get off to the next one. Kind of like the old Dick Clark, you know, tours from way back in the 60s. You know, that was my idea. Or the Happy Together tour, which had started in the 80s, was a good template as well. Yeah. So he understood what I wanted to do, and he said, listen, we haven't really played together, me and my siblings, so I, you know, kind of had a little time apart, and we've lost two of our brothers. They had lost Bill and Barry within a very short time, you know, of each other. But he said, I'm going to be in Las Vegas, let's get together. So I took him out to breakfast, and you know, keep in mind, I'm meeting him face to face for the very first time. And to show you just how deep the loss of their brothers was with him, because he was original. He and Bill pretty much started the Cowsills, you know?
Yeah.
Because they were Beatle fans living in Rhode Island, and they wanted to be the Beatles. You know, that's kind of how it all started. Well, once we started talking about the idea of him playing with Paul and Susan, he just broke down.
Oh, wow.
I didn't know how to act, because I'm meeting this guy for the very first time, and he's literally sobbing over his pancakes at the table with me. And then he looked at me through his tears and he said, you are asking me to do something that probably makes more sense now than it ever did. Of course I want to do this. Count me in. I'm going to go talk to my sister and my brother and see if they'll do it. And they hadn't played together since the early 90s.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that's really cool. And here they are to this day, speaking of Happy Together, they're part of the Happy Together tour. Not now in our COVID world, but they will be again when that's gone. And they've had quite the renaissance, the Cowsills have. And, you know, I was a small part of that at the very beginning, because they really were estranged. Well, you know, they didn't stop loving each other, but I just think the loss of their two brothers... You know, Barry died in Hurricane Katrina. He drowned.
Oh,
wow.
And Bill was sick for a lot of years, and eventually, you know, passed away. So I think it was cathartic for them to get together and sing their hits again.
And it was fun.
On board, we had the Bay City Rollers, or at least whatever we were going to call them, on board. Barry Williams was a green light go as an MC, Greg Brady, because... I was working with Anthony Anzaldo, who was managing him. And he was also our conduit to get to Leif Garrett. Leif initially said no. And it's because he didn't want anything to do with his teen idol past.
Yeah.
You know, he just wanted to play Nirvana songs. And I said to Anthony, who then I think translated to Leif, listen, this is an opportunity for you to get back out, because nobody knows where you've been except on the, you know, on the pages of the National Enquirer, because he'd had trouble legally. You know, he'd been arrested a time or two. And it was like, this is a chance for you to wipe the slate clean. And so what? You know, you got to play, you know, I Was Made for Dancing or whatever. And you're going to find out people love you for that music and for that time. And... let's give you an opportunity to do at least one song that isn't from your past, and you know, that's the give we'll give you. We'll give you a chance to do out of five songs, six songs, whatever it is. You can do one or two that are off the beaten track that weren't run around Sue, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So he said, okay, under those terms, I'll do it. So now we've got, you know, I would say Leif and the Rollers both are, you know, pretty equivalent in terms of their impact on teens, and the Cowsills certainly got a lot of love, you know, in the late 60s and into the early 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Reached out to Tony DeFranco. He was selling houses, and still is, for Sotheby's in Southern California, and he was kind of like, listen, you know, I make a lot of money doing real estate, and it would have to be a pretty good payday for me to do this. And I couldn't guarantee anything at that point. I'm like, I don't even know if anybody is even going to salute this flag. I need to put together a lineup.
Right, right.
So he was like, hey, I'm not going to say no forever, but no for now. Sean Cassidy said no. I'll keep my options open. He goes, you know, I haven't sung those songs in years. I walked off, he told me, he goes, I walked off the field at the Houston Astrodome in 1980, whatever, and didn't look back. He goes, from that point on, that part of my career was over. I'm really enjoying myself in TV and doing what I'm doing. And, you know, I don't know if it's something I would feel comfortable doing. And I said, well, what if we book like a, not just a regular casino show, but what if we got like a really big venue, you know, outdoors, stadium, you know, big, let's say the Hollywood Bowl, would you do it? And he goes, well, the Hollywood Bowl, hell no. He goes, but if you want to get me to Boston or New York, he goes, at least that's far enough away from everybody who I have to see on a daily basis in L.A. So maybe I would. So he had a real good sense of humor about it, but he passed. David Cassidy said no because he was doing his own thing. Davy Jones said no initially, but down the road, and you know, this is way later, he actually came on board.
Oh, wow.
Yes, yeah, so that was cool. And then Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods, because I was looking for someone, again, who could meet the litmus test, because Bo and the band got a ton of coverage in Tiger Beat.
Sure.
Not so much 16 or Teen Beat or 17. For whatever reason, they're pretty specific to the Lawfer publication, as was Tony DeFranco.
Yeah.
And Late was more of a Tiger Beat guy. And I get it now, because I know what that meant, was they had deals with the record companies, mm-hmm. you know? Didn't know it at the time. But anyway, Bo I thought was perfect, you know? He didn't front the band, so he just needed a lead singer. We got one for him. And they agreed, you know, to be the backing band for Leif and anybody else that would need it. The Calisthenics were kind of self-contained, but, you know, it was just the three of them, so they needed a drummer and a keyboard player. And it worked. So we toured 2000, well, we debuted 2006, New Year's Eve, at the Flamingo.
Oh, wow.
Huge show. Great show. Ian and Duncan were fabulous. Every bit of it was exactly what we needed. I got pictures, I got video, you know, so to be able to put together a nice promo pack to move forward. Oh, I forgot. This is important. We licensed the name because the federal trademark in the United States is owned by Jeff Hubbard in Indiana.
Okay.
And so I reached out to Jeff. You know, and Jeff had done tours in the past with Woody and Eric and Alan, and you know, so he was on the inside sort of, but he was fine. So we agreed that. Okay, we're going to use it for this one show, and if it turns into something, then we'll have to do a long-term licensing deal where we pay you X amount of dollars per show to be able to use the federal trademark without any pushback.
Yeah.
You know, and that was what we agreed to do. So we were able to put Ian and Duncan and that band on stage and bill them as the Bay City Rollers without any other. You know, asterisks, you know, which is easier. It's always easier if you can use the name. You know, ask Foreigner. There's not one original member in that band and hasn't been for years, except occasionally Mick Jones. And they make quite a living because they can use the name, you know?
Sure.
Yeah.
So that's what we did with the Rollers. Had a great first show, put together all this promo, then wah, wah, wah.
Well. Isn't there always a wah, wah, wah when it comes to our favorite boy band? Find out next week what went wrong. Thanks for listening, and until then, keep on rolling. No matter what, no matter who, no matter where, keep on rolling.